Greetings, friends. This is a Dhamma talk on the Buddha Sutta, the Sutta on the Self-Governing Principle of Awakening. This sutta was recorded at our Saturday morning Dhamma class in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on September 17, 2016. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. How is everyone this morning? This morning's talk is on, it's from the Adipataya Sutta. And it's about the self-governing principle of awakening. And rather than try to explain that, I'll just read the article. But the sutta touches on how the Buddha awakened, what he awakened to, dependent origination, and how awakening is not something that is grace to us. It's not something that has any... that developing merit or right acts directly helps achieve awakening, although those are an important part of the path. It's through our direct inquiry, study, and development that we develop awakening. And that's, again, that's what the Buddha taught. And he taught it because that's what he did. There was nothing, he didn't gain awakening by, again, by any external means. It was all through his own efforts. And when he awakened, the Buddha never called himself the Buddha, which means the awakened one. He consistently called himself the Tathagata, which simply means, the direct translation is one who has gone forth, but what it means is the first one who has gone forth, meaning he left the, he left being enamored with the world and his craving and clinging to, for the things and clinging to the things of the world. Recognized the, he recognized the allure of separating himself from all of that and seeing himself clearly. In other words, not in his relation to the world, but simply as he is, as his life unfolds. And that's really the profound teaching of dependent origination, because it's ignorant of that process, ignorant of the Four Noble Truths, which explains the process, that suffering arises, that confusion arises. So he taught the Four Noble Truths, consistently, or everything he taught was in the context of the Four Noble Truths for 45 years. I'm starting about in the middle of the article, if you've read it, or if you want to read it. I'm about halfway into it. All of the thousands of suttas in the Pali Canon support developing understanding of dependent origination in the Four Noble Truths. And the Adipataya Sutta, that's from the Anguttara Nikaya, if anybody cares. I don't know if you do. The Buddha, rather than teach a doctrine of no self, now that's another important point of this, the Buddha never taught that there's no such thing as a self, which is what much of the modern Buddhist schools proclaim, and a lot of modern pop spirituality claims that there's no such thing as a self, and that in order to free ourselves, we must gain this space of no self and emptiness and nothingness. And again, the Buddha talked specifically about that, not in this sutta, but in other suttas, that that's just a false teaching going back even to the time of the Buddha. It doesn't address the understanding that what constitutes a self is always in a constant state of becoming. So it's a perfect example that there is something that we can recognize as a self that's always in a process of becoming, is when the Buddha awakened, he didn't just vanish. He didn't achieve this state of nothingness or emptiness or no self. He continued for 45 more years teaching his Dhamma and probably living the most effective human life anybody ever has. When he used that term anatta, anatta means not a self, not no self. And there's a pretty important distinction between the two, isn't there, between not and nothing. He's simply saying that what you think of a self is not a self. It's based on ignorance. It's based on false beliefs. Let go of those views. The Buddha, rather than teach a doctrine of no self, affirms a self that governs the awakening process through a right view of anicca, impermanence, the self, and the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. The Buddha's words from that sutta. There are three governing principles of awakening. The self, the cosmos, and the Dhamma are the governing principles of awakening. The self is a governing principle of the Dhamma. In other words, it's integral to understanding what a self is and not to try to annihilate the self. And how is the self the cosmos? And the Dhamma, the governing principles of awakening. The cosmos, in this sense, is the environment of Anicca. So, again, this is where the cosmological applications of the Dhamma began, simply because of the word cosmos, but a misunderstanding. The cosmos simply means this wandering around in what is called samsara, wandering around in ignorance and creating more confusion. That's the cosmos. It's not a grand cosmic view. It's simply to describe the environment, the entire environment that we are in, and because of our ignorance, that entire environment is dukkha. It's confusion, delusion, and suffering. The Buddha continues, a meditator having found solitude, sitting at a root of a tree or an empty hut, is mindful of not renouncing the world's enchantments for robes or alms or shelter or for mystical states, meaning substituting the appearance of being a Buddhist practitioner for the actual process of developing the Dhamma. This practitioner reflects thusly, I have gone forth, meaning leaving the world behind, to bring cessation to the entire mass of suffering, of sickness, aging, death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, and despair. With myself as the governing principle. That's such a powerful line. With myself. The Buddha's saying directly, if you annihilate this yourself or you try to create this nothingness about yourself, you're going to gain nothing. You're going to go nowhere. With myself as the governing principle, within the governing principle of the cosmos, meaning impermanence, I have developed understanding of dukkha, meaning right here, right now. Within the environment that your confusion and delusion lies in, that same environment allows for the development of profound wisdom, right here, right now, in this lifetime. And that line also points to there's nothing to gain by seeking outside of yourself for awakening. My persistence will continue and not lax. I will remain mindful and clear, my body calm and my mind non-distracted, resting in equanimity. I will abandon clinging to impermanent objects, ideas, and views, and develop understanding governed by the Eightfold Path. Again, the Eightfold Path is the path to pierce through conditioned thinking and develop right view and the rest of the factors of the Eightfold Path. Within the cosmos, there are those with psychic powers, those clairvoyant, who can read the mind of others and can see vast distances, who can recognize conceit and continued eye-making, and the further establishment of the ego self. My persistence will continue and not lax. I will remain mindful and clear, my body calm and my mind non-distracted, resting in equanimity. I will abandon conceit and clinging to impermanent objects, ideas, and views, and develop understanding governed by the Eightfold Path. The Dhamma is clearly taught by the Buddha to be developed here and now. That's the path. This Dhamma is timeless in nature, and is for all who would develop understanding. This is the Buddha's talking about a practitioner here. I would be foolish to dismiss the Dhamma in favor of another Dhamma. My persistence, and this talks to even during the Buddha's time, there was an insistence to take these simple teachings and accommodate it and adapt it to fit the current held views of a self-referential ego self. In other words, instead of recognizing your views are rooted in ignorance, to adapt the Buddhist teachings into that ignorance, and what do you have left? You have a teaching that's still rooted in ignorance because you're making it fit your views rather than using it to recognize and abandon your views. And that was common during the Buddha's time. You've heard me talk about different monks and nuns that left the... never was a nun. The monks that left the Buddha's teachings and started teaching and created their own Dhamma, and the Buddha called them back and said, you can't do that. And that's just as prevalent today. There's almost a value placed on the different adaptations, and it goes back to certain teachers. Dogen's a good example, and I'm not putting Dogen the individual or the Zen type of teaching that grew around him, but Dogen, Bodhi, Dharma, Nagarjuna, a lot of these teachers have created or developed a more important reputation than the Buddha. In other words, we we pay more attention to what was adapted than what the Buddha taught. And many lineages, well, I trace my lineage back to Dogen. Well, why not trace it back to the founder rather than somebody's interpretation of it? And again, I'm not putting down any individual. We're all free to say this is what the Buddha's teachings are. But honestly, I've come across very few people that have established a lineage that really were teaching the Buddha's teaching. They were teaching their own thing. Going back to the origination of even Zen Buddhism, is Bodhidharma is said to be the originator of Zen Buddhism. And there's some connection to the Buddha's teachings in the writings. In other words, Bodhidharma learned his teachings while in India, and then he left and ended up going to China first, and that's where he started. That's where he influenced the beginning of Zen Buddhism, where Chinese Zen is called Chan. But when you read even his early writings that are still preserved, most of them are nonsensical, and none of them ever mention the Buddhist teachings. And you would think that someone that was spreading the Buddhist teachings would mention that, but it's his own teachings. And almost every later developed teacher did the same thing. The Buddha recognized that tendency during his time, and he's saying, don't do it. I'll repeat that too. I would be foolish to dismiss this Dhamma and favor another Dhamma. My persistence will continue and not lax. I will remain mindful and clear, my body calm and my mind distracted, resting in equanimity. I will abandon conceit and clinging to impermanent objects, ideas, and views, and develop understanding governed by the Eightfold Path. So that one line there, actually this whole paragraph, the Buddha is saying this Dhamma is timeless. There's no need to accommodate it or adapt it in any way. This teaching will persist throughout time. And it's the teaching itself that helps you maintain clarity and not get sidetracked with other views and ideas. So here the Buddha is teaching that there is a self that is not prone to confusion and suffering, originating in ignorance, informed by clinging. This is an awakened self that is in constant process of mindful awareness, with no compulsion to establish identity through attachment to what is occurring or through contacting the six senses. Insisting on a definition of self that can be understood from the point of view of an ego personality will always generate additional confusion. In other words, again, adapting this to fit this view that I have of myself, that this self that I have is permanent, it persists, it can be sustained throughout time and throughout the cosmos. When, again, the simple teaching that the Buddha brings us back to, in this moment and for all time, I am in a constant process of becoming. And so that profound understanding then brings your mind to the heart of the matter. What am I going to become? Do I want to continue a life that is really focused on protecting these views and this ego self? Or do I want to free myself of, using the Buddha's words, the bonds of an ego self and allow myself to simply be present with life as life occurs? And then make decisions and create a direction in my life using the framework of the Eightfold Path rather than ignorance of the Eightfold Path. And that really is it. Am I going to use this new view, this right view, to live my life? And in doing so, we create a life of the Buddha, a life of lasting peace and happiness. The big challenge, of course, for everyone is letting go of that ego self, isn't it? That's the problem. And I've been finding myself saying this more and more lately. I think it's because of the current political climate, but and what's going on in the world. If we're really concerned about the world, we'll take to the Dhamma and awaken and stop contributing to that in any way. And then we'll be able to influence the world in a positive way from a realistic point of view. Rather than seeing all the things that are going on in the world and reacting to it, we'll be able to address that situation from a calm and peaceful mind. And imagine if we had calm and peaceful minds in places of leadership all over the world. Imagine if we had, again, sorry to get political, imagine if we had two political candidates that had calm and peaceful minds. Or maybe just one. Wouldn't that be remarkable? I think that even as distracted as we are as a society, I think just one candidate would appeal to so many people. It'd be kind of like a shoo-in.
Well, we had one, but he didn't make it.
Oh, yeah. And look how this is, again, I'm not getting into the politics of it. It's just the things that are developing right now are just remarkable to me. The polls, not that we should put all our money in that basket, but the polls are saying that both of these current candidates have such a highly negative view that in any other situation, in other words, if there was a realistic choice, they wouldn't get any votes at all. And yet we're stuck with it, aren't we? Imagine if there was someone that could really exude peace and real confidence and real compassion to the world. It would be the, you know, another landslide. Who was the first one? Nixon was the last one.
Obama had a landslide.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, and here is a political statement. Yeah, I'm not going to say it. I'm going to resist that. it's just a thought, and I'm not putting down the individual, because the individual I'm about to mention is part of that first noble truth, and I'm sure that she's doing the best she can. I think it's remarkable that in my life, when I was growing up, there was no way that a woman could ever think of becoming president. When Kennedy became president, the big thing was, this is our first Catholic president. It's remarkable that we've developed that even in my lifetime, that a woman could be president. I really think it's unfortunate that it might be Hillary, because she could really affect that. Think of all the great women that there are in this world that could just do a much better job and not be so polarizing. And again, I'm not saying that Trump's any better, but excuse the political commentary. But the point of it is, just imagine if we all took to the Dhamma, we would change the world. And I really think that the Buddha has done that over the 2,600 years. He's certainly changed the world, but there's still a lot more to go, isn't there? Just like our own practice. We've developed a useful and effective understanding of the Dhamma, but there's a little more to do. And again, the framework for all of that is the Eightfold Path. So again, excuse the political commentary. I'm going to go back just a little bit. Here the Buddha is teaching that there is a self that is not prone to confusion and suffering originating in ignorance and formed by clinging. This is an awakened self that is in constant process of mindful awareness with no compulsion to establish identity through attachment to what is occurring or through contacting the six senses. Insisting on a definition of self that can be understood from the point of view of an ego personality will always generate additional confusion. Negating an awakened self or projecting an awakened self into an environment of emptiness arises from the need to define a self from the point of view of the ego self. Founded in ignorance, there can be no wisdom. Attempting to define a self, that's such an important point. It is within this environment of ignorance that we develop awakening. But if we hold on to an ignorant view, we can only develop an ignorant view. We might even incorporate some of the Buddhist teachings, but as it's resting in ignorance, there'll be no useful application in our own life. So we have to be willing to recognize that it is ignorance of these four noble truths that is the real problem, and that's what we're here to develop, that's what the Buddha taught. Attempting to define a self to fit an ignorant view will only develop further ignorance and an ongoing misunderstanding of the Buddha's teaching. So ignorance does not develop into wisdom. Ignorant views are to be abandoned, not adapted to cultural or individual influences. Wisdom replaces ignorance. The Buddha was a human being who, through his own efforts, awakened. Ignoring the significance of the Buddha's awakening begins the delusion of a no-self that somehow becomes well-established in an environment of emptiness. The Buddha did not awaken and suddenly find a non-referential self in an empty environment. The Buddha awakened to a profound understanding of dukkha, originating in ignorance. He lived as an awakened human being for 45 years. He lived 45 years teaching others his Dhamma, who would also awaken and live awakened human lives, free of the delusion of an ego self. Awakening does not annihilate anything worth preserving and does not establish an ego self in some imaginary realm of emptiness. Awakening does not transform the ego self into Buddhahood or Buddha nature. Awakening does not establish the ego self in an imaginary Buddhist heaven of everlasting bliss. And again, I'm not putting down the religion. I'm just pointing out the differences between what the Buddha taught and what has developed. The largest Buddhist school or religion is called Pure Land Buddhism. And it has no connection at all to what the Buddha originally taught. Basically, Pure Land Buddhism teaches that if you develop this certain chant, and I used to remember it, but it's really not important, and continually recite this chant, keep it on your lips and in your mind, and most importantly, if you die with this chant on your lips, when you die, you'll be taken to Amitabha, to that's not Amitabha, I can't think of the name of it, Tulsita Heaven, I think that's what they call it, and forever from that point, you will be protected by Amitabha Buddha, which is sometimes called Avalokiteshvara, or sometimes Kuan Yin, the famous goddess. The Buddha never taught anything. The Buddha never even taught a chant in his life, much less that there was nothing to do except to chant. And yet this is the biggest form of, and again, I'm not putting it down. It's a legitimate religion like any others. It's just not what the Buddha taught. And yet it's called Buddhism. All views arising from an ego self are rooted in ignorance and are not self and are to be abandoned. This is all that is to be abandoned. This is the meaning of abandoning wrong view and entering into right view. The sutta concludes with the following verse. There is no hiding in the cosmos for those of hurtful or foolish deeds. Your own self knows whether you are wise or ignorant. You know the truth within yourself. Those awakened see the fool who misunderstands the cosmos. Conduct yourself with mindfulness, self-governed, governed by the cosmos resting in samadhi, a non-distracted state, meaning you're still in this environment that is prone to confusion and delusion and suffering, but through developing samadhi, a non-distracted state, you'll live in peace. Governed by the Dhamma and thought, word, and deed, the wise one perseveres and never falls back. Through continued right effort, delusion and suffering ends. Reoccurrence ceases. Nice to know that. Reoccurrence ceases in the knower of the cosmos, meaning the one who really understands this whole process.
What was that? What did you just say?
Reoccurrence ceases in the knower.
Reoccurrence.
Okay. Reoccurrence ceases in the knower of the cosmos. I'm reading too fast again, I think.
Reoccurrence is the same thing as rebirth.
Yes. Yeah. That's the most useful application of rebirth. And it points back to the present moment. What are we going to give birth to in the next moment? Well, that depends on what we're bringing into our lives in this moment. And if it's a wise and right view, we will give birth to a moment that is inclined towards awakening and away towards creating more confusion, delusion, and suffering in our own lives. Great question. So you read it the same way. Rebirth, recognizing, rebirth ceases. And that directly relates to when... to what the Buddha says about his own awakening, that there will be no further rebirth when he awakened. One of the great symbols is the Buddha awakening, and he's sitting like this, and he touches the earth with his right hand. And that has all kinds of mystical symbolic views. But what he said is, blah, 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 I have overcome the earth, meaning he's left the draw of earthly desires behind. He's left behind the earth. And then he said, for me, there will be no more future births. He meant that in a literal physical sense, but he also meant it, more importantly, that he is now incapable, just like he said here, of reoccurrence. He's fully awakened. But we've all experienced that mind of calm and peace and equanimity, even if it's just for a brief moment, in our meditation sessions. And I would bet for all of us, off our cushions, even if it's just for a brief moment, we recognize, and I think you were talking about this, recognizing the development you make, how important it is. That's part of that ehipasika, come and see for yourself. Try out the Eightfold Path, and you'll see for yourself how effective it is. Reoccurrence ceases in the knower of the cosmos, wise and non-discriminating with all phenomenal things. Let me just go on one more paragraph. The Buddha did not teach a nihilistic doctrine. The Buddha taught understanding and wisdom. He taught that the hardened belief that the ego self is substantial and worth defending is founded in ignorance, in a wrong view. He taught that the environment that the ego self defines itself in is itself impermanent and ever-changing. By attaching the ego self to impermanent objects, ideas, and views, the confusion and suffering of dukkha arises. One more paragraph. Establishing the ego self in any realm continues delusion and suffering, meaning in a future realm or in this inner Buddha realm or Buddha nature, you're just creating another identity to cling to. If there was such a thing as an inner Buddha nature within this self-referential ego self, how did that profound understanding develop such confusion and delusion? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't add up. And it's not something the Buddha ever taught. He didn't teach to recognize wrong views by developing a worship of yourself, which is really what that idea is. Or that if I meditate, some of the schools are taught, if you meditate long enough and hard enough with enough intention, eventually Buddha nature will arrive or you'll achieve Buddhahood, just kind of a spontaneous thing. And that has a lot to do, doesn't it, with other religions, that if you perform and act in a certain way, you'll be graced or granted heaven or an awakened state, rather than really having to do anything specific, meaning develop the Eightfold Path. Again, I have to keep saying this. I'm not putting down other religions. It's just that there's a significant difference between what the Buddha taught and other religions. When perception arises from right view, the three linked characteristics of anicca, anatta, and dukkha become the governing principles of an awakened self developing understanding of stress within the cosmos. That's it. That's the teaching. Any questions about that? So the whole thing just points to recognizing the need to develop understanding of our own wrong views and develop a right view through the Eightfold Path. Lorna?
Did they have a word for the Buddha? Given that the Buddha didn't use the word the Buddha, and the Buddha means the awakened one, why did they have a word for the awakened one when nobody had awakened? Mm-hmm. You follow what I mean?
I guess when did the word Buddha come in to play?
Oh, well, there...
If nobody's awakened, why did they have a word for the Buddha?
Because it was something that humans have been striving for forever. So even the teachings that the Buddha rejected, which were basically the Vedas, which grew into modern Hinduism, but much later, there wasn't an established Hindu religion back then. The goal of the Vedas and other thoughts were to become awakened. There wasn't an understanding of what that might be. There was different definitions. The great Greek philosophers talked about developing a way to enlightenment or awakening. So it was a concept. It's probably not, the Buddha was probably the first one, you know, he claims to be, I think he was, because there's no, even reading the great Greek philosophers and some of the Roman philosophers, you can see that they don't quite understand what the Buddha's teaching. They had their own understanding. So, when the Buddha awakened, it became known that there is someone who had fully developed an understanding. And so he was just given the appellation of the Buddha. But he never called himself that. It's interesting that the later developed schools then used that to say that there was there's limitless Buddhas and all types of different Buddhist heavens, etc. That there's a future Buddha coming, much like the Christian belief that there'll be a future Savior coming, and there's also going to be a future Antichrist coming. Modern Buddhism claims that there's future Buddhas. One is called Maitreya, who's supposed to come back, some people say right now, any minute, to save the world. Of course, the Buddha never saw himself as a savior because he knew it was an impossible task. Not that it wasn't achievable, because nobody can impose awakening on another person. They can only teach the way. You know, and that's where the three refuges come in. We take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, his teachings, and our Sangha here. Just a quick story about this idea of annihilation and not self and emptiness and nothingness. And I know I've talked about this a few times here. It's about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, I don't exactly remember. I got a phone call from someone who said that he had heard of me. And I could see that there was a lot of agitation in his voice. And he told me he was from Newtown. He says, I'm 38 years old. I live in Newtown. I got a beautiful house. I got a wife, 3 kids, 2 cars. I'm living the dream. I've got everything I ever could dream of. And then he said, and yet I feel like there's nothing in my life. And he says, and I've been meditating for over 20 years. And I started getting an understanding of, you know, I think I know where he's going. And I says, well, tell me a little bit about your meditation. He says, well, I've been a Zen practitioner for 20 years. And my meditation is consistently I enter my meditative state and I focus on nothingness. And I says, tell me again what you said. He says, I enter my meditative state and I focus on nothingness. And through the phone, I could hear the light bulb going off in his head. And he said, holy shit. And he got it. He was experiencing in his life exactly what he was focusing on, putting all his efforts into developing. a sense of nothingness. And he, because of that sense of nothingness, you can imagine this great cloud that he brought over his own mind. He couldn't recognize what was in his own life. And not that we should become attached to things, but he was completely ignorant of his own life in front of him because of what he focused on, focusing on nothingness. And there can even be some release in creating that type of mind that there's nothing here, because then there's nothing for you to do. But how can you develop awakening from that point of view of nothingness? You can't. We create an idea of awakening from understanding life as life occurs, not that there's nothing here. Of course there is. This is life. This is human life. The First Noble Truth points to that and points to a recognition of developing an understanding of that ongoing process. And rather than develop a life of nothingness or emptiness, a fully awakened person is also fully immersed in their own life, because they're not using that self-referential ego self to ignore things that we'd rather not see, including just the mundane aspects of life. We're fully present with everything that's occurring because our minds are not distracted anymore. Any other questions? Thank you for the question.
Just one observation. You mentioned that the monks and the nuns who left the Buddhist teachings and went out to Bruce Lake, the Dharma, and sometimes the monks changed the Dharma and incorporated ego and blah, 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 blah. And it has to be recalled. You just mentioned it right at the beginning of your talk today. But none of the nuns did that.
Well, the reason why I say that, I've never come across any sutta where it mentions a nun misrepresenting the Buddhist teaching. It's probable, but there's no mention of it in the suttas.
But you also mentioned about Hillary Clinton and others, Angela Merkel in Germany, and Theresa May in Great Britain. And I think the women are doing very well at the moment.
Oh, I think so too.
Clinton, I agree with that, it's a changing world for women, and I think that should be acknowledged.
I didn't mention those other leaders. I think it's. I mean, you can go back to Indira Gandhi, you know, when she was leading. This is, I don't know, 30 years ago, isn't it? Maybe even more. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a remarkable leader of India through some really brutal times. Mm-hmm. You know? So, I mean, the effectiveness of women leaders has also been around since the Buddhist time. It's kind of interesting that we're still coming to grips with that, aren't we, in this country? Yeah. I mean, I think, well, again, I don't want to get into a political statement, but that's one of the things that always, when I realized how important the women's role, nuns' role, well, not even, and lay women too, in the Buddhist teachings, and how it's often presented that the Buddha rejected women. He didn't want them in the Sangha. It's just not true. He encouraged women to be in the Sangha, but he also was concerned that because of the political and societal climate in northern India, that they were putting themselves in great danger. Because at that point, women weren't allowed to have any position of power or any position of even acknowledgement, meaning putting on Buddhist robes put women in danger of just being beaten and mauled and murdered just because of that. And that was the concern of the Buddha, that the culture just wasn't ready for it. But after a little bit of resistance and talking to by his aunt and stepmother, he relented and said, they basically said, it's up to us if we get hurt. We want to be part of the Dhamma. He said, you're right. Come on.
I have edited out our 20-minute meditation session. Our Dhamma class continues with our Sangha discussion.
So I'd like to hear how your practice is going. Start with Anthony.
Good to see you this morning, Anthony.
Good to see you. Good to see everyone. I am really looking forward to the next 3 weeks. So I settled my trial yesterday, and I don't start classes for 3 weeks. So I'm really looking forward to deepening my practice.
Oh, yeah.
Getting back to pleasure reading, coming here more often, meditating longer.
Yeah, boy, that's a right view, huh? Really? I think about that, looking forward to it. You have that enthusiasm.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, because I've had to short-circuit things quite a bit.
Yeah. Where are you going to school?
Online.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Which turned out to be a great thing.
Yeah.
because I was literally had an hour and a half to do something, and I brought my laptop to court, and it took all day to get the case settled, and I just had that little bit of time because it had a 5 o'clock deadline, and I'm sitting there thinking, working at 2:30, thinking, I could never do this if I didn't do it online.
Yeah, it's great. The technology's there. So that, well, I'll make the announcement in just a little bit. But
I had a question for you.
Sure.
I look at awakening as sort of like this very elusive concept that I want to aspire to, but I don't think I'll ever quite get there. It's almost like trying to meditate without thinking. You know, there's moments of clarity, and then there's a lot of moments of thinking. And so I wonder, how do you define awakening? And do you think that it's something that everybody can get to, or just the chosen few?
Oh, I don't think it's a chosen few. I can't answer the question, do I think everybody will? I do think that every human being has the potential for awakening. So, and I define awakening, much like the Buddha does, as full human maturity. So it's not something that is extraordinary, or even just to make up the word, extra human. We all have the capability, and the Buddha taught a way for human beings to achieve that full human maturity. So just like a child doesn't understand, you know, a 5-year-old doesn't completely understand even its own world, even the delusionary world. A fully mature human being simply understands completely what's occurring, and that's what the Eightfold Path develops. It is elusive. I think depending on the nature or the level of conditioned thinking makes it more difficult the more conditioned thinking we are, but ultimately even that is the same in each human being. Ultimately there's no gradation. You know, I'm more conditioned than you are, and boy, look at that one, it really conditioned. It still comes back to ignorant views. So, and while it seems elusive, it's also helpful to remember that you can do it. And that's where the three refuges come in. That's the real teaching in the Ratana Sutta, that the Buddha did this, a human being did this, and since he did, we can. He left his teachings. We take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. He left his teaching, the Dhamma, the same teaching that he taught 2,600 years ago and used to awaken, for us to develop. That's, again, it's the reason why I keep harping on the necessity of keeping it pure and well-focused and take refuge in the Sangha, that we have a dedicated group of practitioners right here. We're so fortunate to have it. And again, that talks to how the Buddha always placed importance on associations. Who you associate with and what you associate with determines in a great extent what you're going to become. And that doesn't mean we should spend our whole life in this room. It means to hold that association in mind. That's what guides us. So again, to answer your question, yes, I think everyone can if you fully develop the Eightfold Path. The challenge, even during the Buddhist time, was to stay well-focused, to avoid that distracted state. And I think that might be even more difficult now than it ever was, but you know, that's just a speculation. But with all the distractions that are out there, most of what appeals to human beings in general are those things that distract us the most. You know, and think about it. You know, the modern millionaires, most of them have made their money because they found a niche way of distracting us in a very effective way. You know, Mark Zuckerberg, etc.
I mean, just when I think I'm awakened, life comes over and bonks me over the head, and I'm unawakened.
Well, so you got to get rid of the wife. Right? You bring up another practical difficulty. It is much easier to move into the forest if you really want to awaken, but it's also not practical for most of us. So we do the best we can, but also understand that many householders, many lay people have awakened all since the Buddhist time, but many during the Buddhist time. I always mention Anatha Pandinka, the benefactor. Because he awakened and then continued his his home life, he was able to keep financing the Buddha and his monks, you know, throughout most of the Buddha's teaching career. King Ashoka is another one. King Ashoka awakened. This is about 300 years after the Buddha's passing. King Ashoka awakened. He didn't leave the throne and go live in a forest. In fact, King Ashoka is another reason why we still have the Buddha's teaching, because he made it his point then to use his power and influence to establish and maintain the Buddha's teachings where it was never established before, including going into Sri Lanka.
Do you think awakening means never getting angry?
Again, it gets very subtle. So it does not mean, and yes, in a reactionary sense, but it doesn't mean that you don't come across something in your life that you don't approve of, but you accept it because it's what's occurring. And so you could say there's incidences where it sounds like the Buddha's being angry when he called people back in, or he was challenged people in a so-called debate. And he would use words like "you foolish man" or "you worthless man." I mean, these are the translations from Pali, but it's strong language.
Yeah.
But he's using it in a very compassionate way to make a point, to try and get through to somebody. So it's not a derogatory thing in that sense to say you're foolish, you're worthless. What he's saying is that the way you hold yourself and the way you see the world is foolish. And here's a way to not be foolish.
So it's in the, you can feel it, but it's in the way you deal with it.
Yes. Much like a doctor would say, you know, I notice you're smoking 3 packs a day. That's foolish. It's his responsibility to say it. He's not telling you you're a completely foolish person, but an act that you're engaged in is a foolish act if you want to maintain your health. If you want to develop full maturity, continuing to protect an ego personality is foolish, and it's worthless in relation to the Dhamma. So it's a great question, and it shows a deepening understanding of the Dhamma. One of the ways that I recognize it now, because I've been teaching, is I know that people are getting it by the questions they ask. And if the questions are pointing towards the heart of the matter, you're developing the Dhamma. And if the question has to do with, and I get a lot of questions about why me, why do I have to do this? Well, you don't have to do it, but then you're just protecting an ego self. And that shows that your mindfulness is not right now going in the right direction. But it's such an important question. You know, can we do it? Of course we can. You know?
I'm sorry, I think I cut you off from making an announcement.
Oh, no, it was something you said about the online, about your online learning. I don't know if you noticed, I'm starting a streaming Dhamma class. Actually, the first streaming will be, or the first class will be this Wednesday at noon.
Wow.
It's kind of a dry run, but the link is in this week's email. You need to register. And if you have a computer with a webcam and a microphone, you can actually be seen on screen if
Wow.
you want, and you can interact.
That's great.
If you don't, or you'd rather not be seen on screen, you can just type some questions and be a part of it that way. But the technology has, it's this platform called Crowdcast. And it's really remarkable. I've been wanting to do this for a long time because of online students that feel isolated and also maybe to stream the classes here. But the only thing that was really available was Google Hangouts, and that doesn't work very well, and it's limited to 4 or 5 people. This is literally unlimited. So the first class, I expect to have about 30,000 people on it, if I have 1 or 2. But you could have. And I gave a talk for another organization called Worldwide Insight, worldwidehealinginsight.org. They kind of interviewed me, and I gave a little Dhamma talk last Saturday, and it worked beautifully well. It's really remarkable how well it worked. And there were people online that could ask questions. I'm going to start that on Wednesday at noon, and eventually I'll be adding some other times. I'm getting some feedback from people all around the world. I have Australia's an interesting place. There's probably 15 or 20 people in the country of Australia that have taken the course and all kind of say the same thing. There's no place around us for it to get together. And then there's a bunch of people on the East Coast. There's a small group in Italy, some people here and there. So I'm trying to come up with times that will accommodate everyone. I don't know how I'll be able to do that. So I'm thinking that maybe Monday I'll have a 6 a.m. class for those of us on the East Coast. And also, I think that Melbourne, where most of these people are, I think that's 12 hours behind this. So it would be 6 p.m. on Sunday, which should be convenient for them.
Well, maybe if there's a way you can record it, and then they can just click on it and watch it.
It's instantly recorded. Once the streaming cast is done, I hit a button and it goes right to YouTube, but I can also embed it on the website. So, yeah, they'll all be recorded.
Wow, that's so great.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah.
It means if anybody moves, we can still be part of the song.
Yeah, well, that's it. So that, and I'm really looking forward to streamcasting the Tuesday night class. There's
what will that involve?
It just involves me to bring it.
Neighbors.
Well, that's the one thought that I had. Somebody, they didn't say they wouldn't, they don't want it, but they voiced a concern because they
confidentiality.
Well, confidentiality, yeah. But the only person that will be seen is me.
Okay.
And if anybody, and this is the way I thought of it, if anybody does not want to be
heard
or acknowledged, I can just change your name. In other words, this person has a certain name, and I'll call her something else if that's her concern. Mm. And that protects anybody's anonymity. And I certainly understand that, you know. And if it makes people uncomfortable, maybe I won't do it, but I hope I can.
No, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I don't want, even if it was just one person that stopped coming because of it, I wouldn't want. One of the most important parts of a sangha is that it feels safe here. And if that makes people feel not safe, then it's not appropriate, you know, no matter how much benefit. I'll figure out other things. But.
Yeah, or you could potentially have a recorded one and a non-recorded one.
That's an idea. Well, the other thought that I had is eventually I might just add. So the right now the model is going to be a 10-minute Dhamma talk, 20-minute meditation, and time for Q&A, but probably around 45 minutes in length. But eventually I might do just a full like we do here. It might be a longer talk. We'll see what develops. But that's going to start Wednesday. If you'd like to participate, I really appreciate it because you know just I want to get used to the technology myself. You can go on the website. There's a link there. There's another website that I built called dhammastream.com. You can go there and register. And if you have any input as to times, let me just send me an email. Say you'd like to see this at a certain time. I'm going to send an email out asking that, too. So I might as well get the other announcements out of the way now. The next Dhamma dinner has been established. It's going to be November 22nd, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. For the first time, Julie, the owner of Love and Oven, she's always been so gracious. And she's never asked for a single thing, although we've given her some money in the past, and we've had help setting her up and cleaning up at the end of the night. But she asked specifically if we could have some volunteers that would help set up and clean up at the end of the night. And I'll have a sign-up sheet online by the end of the weekend and also send an announcement out. And more is going to be what's the right word?
Organizing.
Organizing that and the gifts. And she also asked formally for a contribution. So we'll take a Dhamma donation up for that we can just give to Julie and compensate her for, you know, really, this is the seventh dinner, which is really remarkable.
It's
a lot of work for them.
And
she's been paying her, like again, we've given her money in the past, but she's never asked it. So I want to get a donation together. If we can give her $200 or $300, that'd be great. We certainly should be able. So that's November 22nd, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. I talked about the streaming. I am.
Is that on the dinner on the website?
It will be.
Okay.
I just started putting it together, and there's a flyer out there, a couple of them. If you want to take them, and I'll put some more. I'm now teaching in Flemington on Wednesday nights and Lambertville on Thursday nights. Flemington will continue at least till the end of the year, and we might make some adjustments in the early next year, time and place. Lambertville, I will stop teaching there in the end of October and start teaching in Clinton on Thursday nights beginning in November. And all of that will be on the website at that. Hunterdon Healthcare has a wellness center up on 31. Some of you know of it, some of you, you know. It's right. It's just north of 78 on the right-hand side before the first gas station you get to. So that's easily accessible, too. It's a really nice facility, and there's some benefits, especially if you're part of a health club and you want to join that one. You get a discount on the classes, et cetera. So it's a pretty good deal. So, Laura, how's your practice?
My practice is pretty
good. Yeah, let's see. I'm a little bit tired right now. relatively focused and in remembering to follow the Eightfold Path and daily, and keeping that in mind, and relatively focused with my meditation practice, getting at least one meditation in. School started, and things are a lot busier, so there's sort of this adjustment window with everyone's shifting needs and timing, and I started working again, so. But the other morning, Olivia, you know, it's like, grab my phone, which she's not supposed to do, but it's like, let's go meditate, Mom, come meditate with me. So it's really been so beautiful to see
how she's seven?
The consistency of my practice has rubbed off a little bit, and that we actually, you know, Aldo's already, you know, on his way to school, but the four of us actually sat down and meditated for 10 minutes. I mean, you know, June was on my lap and kind of rocking around it. And Olivia sat there and loved to be in charge of waiting for the timer to go off.
That's great. You gotta send
so
me a
wonderful.
Selfie of that. Put it on the website.
Yeah, and impermanent at the same time. I'm not really clinging to that experience again, but it happened and it was great. So
that's amazing.
You know, perfect example of how I feel like, you know, doing your own work.
Yeah.
With a path, and yes, doing your own, what did you call it,
self-awakening?
Self-awakening, or what was the term from the sutta today?
Rightly self-awakened one.
Something, some term, because I can't remember words as well as I wish I could. Anyway, it comes to me much slower than that. So I just doing my own work is rubbing off on the people around me, my children. I can see slowly, and so it's really great. And you know, Anthony, I have a question that whole, like, I've had that question, you know. When you're awakened, do you, you know, still get angry and blah, 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 blah? And definitely come to understand that, you know, as a human being, we are absolutely going to have all the range of emotions that a human being can possibly have. But yeah, I do think it's sort of the, just with a thought in our, you know, in our meditation practice, the recognizing of it and the letting it go. And then from that place, you're able to respond, you know, compassionately, but I mean, I'm sure we will, even the Buddha, I mean, I can't really speak for him, but I'm sure he had all sorts of range of feelings that arose and fell.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he was able to respond appropriately. Yeah, anyway, good to be here. Sangha is so important. I, you know, missing 2 weeks of Sangha, you know, the clouds kind of come in a little bit, but just coming on Saturday for 2 weeks, that really keeps my week much clearer. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all that. I'm glad you made it today. The, you know, just to reiterate that, when the Buddha described an awakened human being, it was in completely practical terms. He said that one is released or unbound, released or unbound from clinging, and ultimately clinging to views of a self-referential ego self. We let go of the views. We gain right view. And he described the mind of an awakened human being as calm. Another word is equanimity. So you're right. The Buddha had, just like any other human being, he had the whole range of emotions, but they weren't coupled with reaction. And this is true of any human being. You feel what you feel, but it doesn't need to be any different. So if a situation arises that you don't approve of, You don't need it to be any different. You don't need another person to be any different. You don't need yourself to be any different. You can just simply be present with what's occurring, meaning, and so you accept it. This is what's occurring. And then if you're in a position to offer assistance or true compassion to someone else, meaning if that other person is open to it, then you can respond in an appropriate way. And you might use terms like you're a fool by the way you act, or you're worthless, but simply to make the point. And so you can see someone's actions as being foolish without having a self-referential view that they're foolish but I'm not. Do you see the difference between just recognizing someone's acting in a foolish way?
I feel like you have the Eightfold Path to fall back on it in those moments, as, I don't know if this is the right thing to say, but just as some sort of moral center to refer to. So
is that a right action?
That's the point.
Yeah.
If the Eightfold Path then is simply the framework for how the first factor of the Eightfold Path is right view. The Eightfold Path is simply the framework for how to establish and maintain the right view of the world. How you see this. And how you see the world is kind of the same way as what you associate with. How you see the world is how you're going to experience it. And if you see the world as a very competitive, aggressive place where you need to always be on top and always establish yourself, you're always going to be in a state of agitation. When you realize that everything is in a state of becoming, including the quality of your mind, that's why I say that at the end of meditation, notice the quality of your mind, it's always in a state of becoming. But if you can become a fully mature human being, then the state of your mind is always calm and at peace, no matter what's occurring, even when you're angry. And that sounds almost impossible until you can experience it, but I used to say this more often than I do now. We can be at peace with less than peaceful mind states because we recognize this is simply what's occurring. This is simply what's occurring. Right now, my mind state is agitated by what's coming into it, but I don't need it to be any different. So even in that agitation, you recognize the process of becoming. You remain at peace in relation to what's occurring, at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. We can do that, and when we can do that with ourselves, I think we have to do it with ourselves before we can do it with other people, but when we can do it with ourselves, then we can be at peace with less than peaceful people. Because we've developed it within ourselves. And isn't that the ultimate freedom? We don't need anything to be different than it is. That's what we're all striving for in this world. Really, it's to be at peace. And in order to do that, the Buddha recognized we have to let go of views that incline the mind to not be at peace. Great question, great comments. Let's see what Jen has for us. Putting the pressure on you. It's good to see you, Jen.
Oh, it's good to see everybody. Yay. Good to see everyone. Today was very distracted. Like, I feel like I missed half of your talk because you said something that, like, I went into my brain about and then kept coming back and then listening for a few minutes and then going back into my brain. And so, but everybody's comments have been doing the same thing. So that's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. The third refuge is Sangha.
But one interesting kind of moment that happened today in class is that I've sort of been obsessing is a strong word because I've done a lot of obsessing in my life. I wouldn't call this obsessing in relatively for me, but I've been thinking about this interaction that I had with a colleague yesterday. And we had I guess you could call it a disagreement where we were sort of, we both had different ideas on how to proceed with a project. And there were moments where I was feeling frustrated and you know, having these sensations that were arising, and in the moment I was recognizing them and moving through them and having conversation and communicating and you know backing down when it made skillful sense, and, you know, proceeding and trying to make my point at times where it made sense, and then I came out of it, and I still, even though there was, you know, significant resolution and things were good, I came out of it still having this sort of, like, these sensations of frustration and irritation. And that was the time where I just kept, it's still with me right now, still with me. And having this talk has made me realize that, you know, I'm hanging on to it somehow, and I'm hanging on to it. I'm reanalyzing how I handled that situation, and I'm thinking about it in terms of you know, how I do things and how she does things, and just kind of clinging to it. And something that you said and that you said and that you said just kind of made me realize, like, oh, I can just let all that go, because as long as I know how to figure things out in the moment. And I did pretty well in that moment.
Yeah.
And it's like residual shame or a feeling that I've somehow relented a little bit, or, you know, or feelings of, you know, frustration that I didn't, that she didn't completely do everything the way I wanted it to be done.
Yeah, bingo.
It's all ego,
yeah,
that is holding on to that. There's nothing really there to work out or to keep analyzing. Yeah, there's nothing there.
Yeah. So what a great description of clinging or attachment.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like you wanted her to be different, and
yeah,
you wanted yourself,
yep,
to be different.
Yeah.
Simply then, but you also recognize that underlying that is simply, this is what occurred.
Yeah.
And without analyzing it, the more you can accept it, the more that will free your conditioned response the next time the situation comes up, because
mm-hmm,
you've established that in your mind. So, I mean, I would say good for you, even though you still have some agitation over it. You recognize,
yeah,
the agitation is born of clinging.
Yeah, and I also feel like what I've been doing is saying to myself that I have something to work out here so that this doesn't happen again.
Yes.
And really letting that go is what's going to make sure it doesn't happen again. Or,
which is,
or just,
or
you know, it'll happen again and I'll figure it out.
And you also mentioned how the developing the Eightfold Path as the, you mentioned this too, Laura, developing the Eightfold Path as your framework for looking at things and experiencing life,
yeah,
frees you from being anything different. In other words, was my behavior within that framework? And if it was outside of it, if there were some aspects, even minor, that were unskillful, you simply recognize it so that you can abandon that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a calm and peaceful mind is able to develop, rather than reacting and trying to place blame either on someone else or even yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you just see the situation clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay. If you had a contributing factor to an unpleasant situation, fine. That's what occurred. What's most important is to recognize that we have a framework for ending that conditioned response. That's the most important thing. Again, it's why I always say be gentle with yourself, because if you judge yourself harshly because you got some changes to make in your behavior or your view, that's just the point. That's part of the first noble truth. The second noble truth would say, in this case, it's because you want the situation to be different.
Yeah.
That creates an ongoing situation. It also keeps you stuck in the past.
I was seeing that while it was happening, but coming here and talking has made me see, like, even kind of more, like, of a deeper or more layers of it. Because I also recognized that the reason why I was thinking things needed to be done a certain way was because I had an expectation of how it was going to end and how the project was going to be at the end and how I was going to have, you know, contributed to this awesomeness and this legacy, and that's all ego, you know, so.
It's all of you, isn't it?
Right, and it's all, like, irrelevant.
Yeah, and what the...
Inaccurate.
The direct term is a mental fabrication,
right.
But it's just another... This is how things should be. This is how I vision it. This is how it must be. And if it doesn't fall that way, I'm upset because it's not developing in the way that I want it to develop. Rather than nothing develops the way we want it to develop.
Right.
Look at how the Buddha described dukkha. You know, not getting what we want is dukkha. In short, and then he concludes by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates, which simply means the views that I'm holding of myself. In short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. Meaning holding on to these mental fabrications, holding on to these views is suffering.
I have to say, I really had this moment on Monday where it really came together. I was, talking with my daughter's teacher, and I just think too much about things, and it's so funny because it never turns out the way I'm thinking about it anyway. And I, hearing you talk, and it was like this unclinging of,
mm-hmm.
I mean, these things are the form, feeling, perception, mental fabrication, and consciousness is going to constantly be occurring in us, but it's really this, the unclinging of that all of a sudden, there is so much more time in heaven.
Yeah.
There's so much more time to breathe
yeah.
and so much more time to actually do the work that needs to get done without, thinking is good. Thinking has to occur, but if I think about it again, will it really happen? Think about it again. Can I think it into halftime?
Or can I change the path? If I keep thinking about something that happened, can I change it?
Once I dropped, even in the moment of having this interaction with her, there was a point where I was that was my trigger for saying, oh, okay, wait, you're
mm-hmm.
very agitated.
Beautiful.
This is, ego. You have to, just take a minute. Just that recognition for that second was enough for me to, relent in the conversation, and I realized that I was totally negating this other being who has a lot of input and expertise and experience and wisdom that I was just, it was like everything you're saying, I was just pushing all of that away and, just relenting that little bit allowed, as uncomfortable as that relenting was, she, is bringing a whole thing to the program that I'm just have to allow
yeah.
if I want it to be good.
The Tuesday night talk was on the Vitaka Sintana Sutta.
Sorry. You're like a cow.
Yeah.
Can I just say something?
Sure.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is your input to your own dukkha.
Right.
You're beginning to learn
craving and clinging.
That this about yourself is creating your stress situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big learning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you could learn that.
That's the essence of it.
You see that?
Yeah.
That's big.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
You've had a big day yesterday and today.
Sometimes we all blame ourselves for being angry and not recognizing that we realized it and self-evaluated and you recognized it, so there's no reason to be angry about being angry.
Right.
Yeah, so you recognize, you experience the Salata Sutta, the second arrow,
mm-hmm.
and the importance of recognizing that whole process. And Tuesday night's talk was on the Vitaka Sintana Sutta. And in that sutta, called the Relaxation of Thought Sutta, the Buddha teaches that ultimately what we can do and what we develop is a relaxed way of thinking. Which means that if you think about best description again, you come home from a long day and you find your easy chair and you sit down and you relax, you're letting go of the day. In that sutta, the relaxation of thoughts, the Buddha's teaching to let go of this ongoing need for constant thinking, meaning in a analytical, discerning way, rooted in ignorance. Let go of those thoughts. Relax those thoughts. And in other suttas, the Buddha talks about, as you develop the Dhamma, you have more time and energy for life, simply because you're not distracted and you're not engaged. It takes an awful lot of energy to keep that mind constantly churning. As our mind's quiet and our body's quiet, we have more energy. And it seems like we have more time. And we do, because we're not doing things that are unnecessary. It's very, very practical. Great talk. Diane, good morning. How are you this morning?
This has been fun.
Come on in.
I'm with you. I had a vision during meditation this morning that tickled me, and kind of I didn't have any clue that it was going to fit the way. Anyway, this is the vision. You know those lottery boxes with all the ping pong balls in them with the numbers on them, and this number 21 is what Aristotle said, and what 52 is what Jesus said, and what Sungsu is what Buddha said, and this is what my mother said, and that number is what my father said, and this is what, you know, the philosophy professor at college said, and this is what my best friend said. You know, all these balls jumping around in this lottery box, and with this air poofing them up and mixing them up, and all of a sudden in this vision I saw the whole thing explode, and all of the ping pong balls just went into nothingness, and there was this beautiful it looked like a sunset sunrise kind of landscape that was just cloudless and just free and no ping pong balls. And I saw the ping pong balls as a conditioned thinking.
That's right, yeah.
And one of the things that comes to my mind now, when I'm agitated or have the aggregate or whatever, it seems like an automatic let it be. Mother Mary, let it be. And I'm not Catholic. I mean, that I'm just thinking of the song, let and I sing it. And it's a peaceful, let it be. And it's a deer walked in front of my car on Sunday night. And I was amazed at my reaction. And I've watched my ego all week long try to, well, that could have been a bicyclist, or it could have been a whole lot more. Mm-hmm. And then let it be. Let it be just comes in, and it's all okay. It's fun. I mean, it's just in that the just see recognizing the ping pong balls and then the ego is the boxing them around, and then ego creates the box, and then just let it be. Lets it. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm happy you're here. That it's a great vision. The ping pong balls exploding and disintegrating into nothing. When the Buddha's words for awakening is nibbana, and nibbana means to extinguish, meaning to extinguish the passions of an ego self. Same thing. It's extinguished. It's gone. Good for you. Eva, good morning. How are you?
Good to be here. Wonderful to be here with everyone. My meditation is going well. I am on a good path towards the night, later in the day, second meditation. It's been very satisfying and rewarding to be able to include that in my life. I am especially glad because I obviously, with hearing what everyone has had to say and the lesson and all, that it was helpful to the situation that I was finding myself confused in, which was something from the past coming up, and then me going back to analyze kind of, this how I looked at it was like that baggage, and I opened up the suitcase, and I was looking at it, but not with, you know, anger or why or whatever. It was just like, oh, that's why, you know. Put it back in there and move away from it. And I only can really say that now I can fully better grasp it, because in hearing what everyone has to say in the class and everything, it just kind of flip, put everything in its more logical sense, and it was more confusing to me before, because I was saying, you know, why do I have to go and think about that in the past, and how is it, you know, why is it affecting my today, and it really does, meditation really does clear a lot off your plate,
yeah.
So that it's not overwhelming you, and that's what I was feeling at. And when I first came in here, I felt very overwhelmed and very sad because of the state of the world and everything, and you know, and but all that, you know, you have to kind of put it aside and be grateful for what we have.
Thank you.
You know, interpreting that Pali Canon for us, making it so much easier for us to.
You're welcome. The state of the world is certainly something that should have our attention. It's not something we should avoid, but also remember that it's all part of that first noble truth, and it's caused by the second noble truth. All the troubles in the world ultimately come down to egos or grouped egos trying to establish themselves and maintain themselves. You know, self-referential views. All that competitiveness and aggressiveness comes from that, you know. And so we understand, as we develop our own understanding of our own confusion, delusion, and suffering, we understand how it occurs in other people and in the world. It doesn't make it right, but it also doesn't make it wrong. You know, that's an important thing to understand. If we're truly going to be helpful in the world, people aren't wrong. What develops is wrong. It's unskillful. It's hurtful. But the root cause of it is ignorance. It always is. You know, it always is. You're going to say something?
I will take a step further and admit something that I kind of didn't want to admit. that this thing that came back from the past and then presented itself to me in this present was presented in the form of jealousy and envy. And it was very difficult to realize that. It was just, you know, I just like, wait, how could I feel jealous? Why would I feel jealous? You know, and it really was that, and I felt that I had to then begin to take certain actions in order to deal with that jealousy, and then I'm better able now to see that I have to let it go, that it's not helpful, and that I can't change the past. I can't go back and change the past to make something now look different or be different or whatever. It's just releasing
and letting go. Yeah, it is. It all comes back to that.
So. When you think of that, I get kind of excited. A woman is running for president. Like you said, 50 years ago, that was unthinkable.
Yep, completely.
And you can
in our lifetime.
Online course.
Yeah, yes.
You can do an online course and improve yourself without having to worry about traffic or hitting deer or a whole lot of other things. I mean, it's the cup full or is it half empty? And I think that when the ping pong balls just burst out of everything, you start seeing the landscape as entirely the way it's supposed to be. The way it's meant to be, the way it is, and it's okay. I mean, and the thing I'm hearing a lot that I catch in myself, this let it be without judgment, let it be without judgment, and it's a judgment are those ping pong balls that says this is right, this is the way it should be, and let it be without judgment, and let the love and kindness fill me.
Thank you.
It's right, because the flip side of the whole online media, Facebook, social media craziness that's occurring is the ability for people to get educations online. And so many of the people I'm schooling with are military people, women who have single mothers, people like me who are professionals that have full-time jobs that are pretty demanding. So it's allowing new Hillary Clintons to emerge.
Yeah.
And so that's the good thing about it. You know, so I think very, as dangerous as online stuff is, it's also a great side. Like, you're online.
Yeah.
You know, you're spreading the word online. So it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, things aren't all bad and things aren't all good. You know, things are just what they are. And so there's good and bad on the internet, and the internet is what it is. That's it. And so we use discernment, you know.
Just not fast enough.
Yeah. I started online before there was even graphical interfaces.
Remember everything. When you had to wait for the dial tone?
Yeah. Talk about slow. You know, but you know, it's remarkable how we've developed. And a lot of it has to do with the way we communicate with each other. And again, good and bad. You know, it's part of the first noble truth. You know, there's going, no matter what, the first noble truth, dukkha can be described as unsatisfactory or disappointing. So the internet at times is unsatisfactory and disappointing, and at times it's exhilarating. Or sometimes just simply practical. You know? It's all part of it. Lorna, how are you?
Feeling under pressure right now. As I said to from your Tuesday talk, there was a moment where you kind of just sat on your cushion and said you just can't beat your ego. You just can't do it.
Can't get ahead of it.
You just can't get ahead of it. You said it so sort of clearly and positively that night. I know you've said it a lot of times, and I've heard it a lot of times, but I really sort of took it in. And I realized, and I sort of woke up with it on Wednesday morning, and I've started realizing that there's, you know, about your ego, and I just sort of said, well, okay, that's that then. You know, I just reconciled with the fact you can't beat or get ahead of your ego, and I just kind of, okay, that's that then.
Yeah.
And I felt so much calmer this week, and I've been thinking about, and your ego is getting, you know, getting back to you prefer a red one and not a blue one and all that sort of stuff. Takes you back to dependent origination. Realize that our views from dependent are perhaps from your mom or perhaps from your dad and your surroundings when you were a kid and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, you can punch advertising in with that.
Oh, of course.
Sure.
It's all
sure.
All advertising is addressed at the ego.
Exactly. And that just dawned on me.
Yeah, pretty much.
And we're like big fish with our mouth open waiting for the hook. We really are.
Entertain me.
I've been preferring this product, preferring that product. And who knows, there might be just advertising at the bottom of it.
Do I need it? Do I need, you know, is it essential?
And that itself has gotten more aggressive.
That was kind of like mind-blowing to me.
Don't yeah.
It's just so subtle
to someone else, yeah.
That I've come across in my life
so many hooks.
That's had an input and gone into my brain, you know, and therefore I prefer this to that. And to it. That's ridiculous. This is ridiculous.
Never really.
So all this thinking that we're doing, I kind of like
irrelevant.
Ping pong ball.
Cleared it out a little bit and analysed it. That you know, the dependent and sort of just look dependent. And then I got to be thinking, well, I'm sitting at the table and comparing things. Really, the comparison to two different objects. It's just the difference I see between them. So if there's a chocolate chip cookie there,
judgment,
and a tomato,
judgment,
the difference between the two is what I see.
Yeah, they're both food.
So, how can I describe it? I kind of lost my train of thought. It's kind of like fuzzy in thinking at the moment. I haven't sort of really clarified it.
Do you feel a sense of freedom when you
have
that
observation?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But just seeing that the difference between two things is what I see, which is maybe different to what you see. Maybe you see the difference between a chocolate chip cookie and a tomato different to what I see, the chocolate chip cookie and tomato. It's what we see between the two as an individual, which is going back to dependent. Do you follow it?
Yeah.
Do you follow what I mean?
Yeah.
So I've been a, you know, a trip almost.
It's so exciting.
Yeah.
It is. So you're describing very directly that confusion, delusion, suffering, dukkha is dependent on ignorance. Ignorance of what? Four Noble Truths. The heart of the Buddha's teaching. It's all that he ever taught is developing understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And he taught the Fourth Noble Truth, the Eightfold Path, to develop profound, you know, right here it says, an awakened, a right view is a view that understands, fully comprehends dukkha. Right view has abandoning the cause, the ongoing cause of dukkha.
Can I just say something else in my mind? That I can also see the difference between how I look at things as my own suffering, of my own suffering, my own dukkha. The suffering that I'm putting into my life, my I know all this is what you've been teaching me for don't 6 years, but I'm just beginning to, I feel like begin to see the dukkha that I'm putting into my life.
Yes. Yay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, your contribution.
I'm responsible.
And so I think I've had a big, big, big week, you know.
But
I haven't quite cleared it all.
But that's the point. You're recognizing the difference.
Yes.
Imagine yourself saying this a year and a half ago. You couldn't, could you?
Even
because you didn't have the frame of reference to say it, to see it. That's the Eightfold Path. It gives us the frame of reference to see things clearly, to see our own contribution to our ongoing confusion, delusion, and suffering. You described it. We all described it beautifully this morning. It's remarkable. But this is how it works. This is how it should work.
Do we get an A?
most of you.
Judgment.
I'm not going to say who doesn't. Cling to that.
I want to say something, right? Based on what you were talking about, how you kind of like were like feeling it and realizing something, and you were like, oh, I know you've been teaching me this for the past 6 years, but like I'm finally, and that was happening to me today when I was driving here, because I was thinking about how ultimately everything that I ever worry about can be boiled down to worrying about how it's going to make me feel, or how I think it's going to make me feel, or how I'm not going to feel in a way that I want to feel in that future moment, which is absurd.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, is that what matters? Is that why meta is so good? Because we're thinking about other people.
Well, and also about ourselves. Meta isn't just about other people. It's also about how we're thinking about ourselves. And it starts with that. It starts with loving kindness towards ourselves and then to all other people. You know, that's so important to recognize that. And it's something else that's overlooked in a lot of modern circles. So one of the things, kind of an underlying theme for the past 5 or 6 weeks, underlying with the teachings too, is to recognize when we're caught up in our heads about anything, whether it's anger, sadness, extreme happiness, they're all agitated mind states, to recognize this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. I don't have to continue to create a relationship with this thing that I'm not. I don't have to keep creating an identity over wanting something to be different than it is or wanting more of something. What's in our lives is simply what's in our lives, whatever it is. And that way, that view is the correct view of the three marks of existence. None of it's personal. What a great class.
What a great class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you, Congressman.
Yeah, thank you all.
Thank you.
It really is remarkable. So there's another, you know, I always think a little bit about the anonymity of everyone here. I don't think anybody bothers. It bothers anybody. But again, I keep getting feedback from people online that hear the discussion after class, and it's so helpful to everyone. I mean, you really are having an effect. We all are. Just the way a sangha should, we're having an effect all over the world, really. So thank you all. Let's finish with the Buddha's words on metta. So the Karaniya Metta Sutta shows that the most loving and compassionate action that anyone can take is to engage wholeheartedly with the direct teachings of the Buddha and awaken. The Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a remarkable class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.